So welcome to Food Conversations, season four. Now, before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today, we are joined once again by Dan and Kat Saxton, co-owners of Pilgrim's Produce, a 14-acre small-scale certified organic farm just south of Armstrong and east of Highway 97. So Kat and Dan, welcome back to Food Conversations.
Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, thanks again.
Delighted to have you here with us. Now, when Kat and Dan were previously in our show, we reviewed the serendipity, which I believe is a universal principle of human experience, which brought them one step at a time to buy this well-established and productive farm and continue it along its successful course, serving local and regional customers with a wide range of healthy local produce. Now, since April 1st, 2021, April Fool's Day, but also a momentous day in their lives, Kat and Dan have been proud owners of a farm started by Robert and Catherine Hettler exactly 30 years earlier to the day. However, both of you knew this farm well already. Just a couple of words about how you knew the farm, each of you. Dan, you knew the farm.
Yep, we'd been working on it for 6 years before, so we had a good lead up to taking it over. I don't think it would have been possible to walk on the farm April 1st and take over.
That would have been a,
no.
That would have been a tragedy. And Kat, you'd also been working there, but even longer.
Yes, yeah, I started working on the crew with Robert and Catherine about 14 years ago and just got to know the farm and the land by working every day for several seasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing like getting your hands in the dirt and seeing what is done on a practical basis. So let's get down to the practical world of running a farm. Now, since one of the options you offer your customers is the opportunity to come to the farm and pick their own strawberries in season, which is conventionally called U-Pick, let's start with exactly where your farm is and how strawberry aficionados and others could get to it. So why don't you give us an idea of the location?
Yeah, we're just south of Armstrong, off the highway, on Eagle Rock Road. And it's pretty conveniently located for most people. It's really close to Vernon too, so 10-15 minutes the other way to Vernon. The neat thing is we get people from all over, though. I don't know if Kat wants to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get sometimes even tour buses just dropping in, and it's quite
a tour bus. Tour bus.
That might not be our top type of customers, since they just want to sample everything and they don't really want to fill their pails, but yeah, it's fun to have people that are excited to get their hands and picking their own fruit. Yeah.
So when a tour bus arrives, how do they tell you they knew you were there?
Through Google. Our website. Yeah, Google.
Oh, really? I'll be darned. Well, the digital world is a whole different world in some respects. Okay, so they drive down the road, and they see your driveway, and they see a sign, and it says Pilgrim's Produce. Now, Pilgrim's Produce, of course, is a play on words. It's a play on the Christian allegory entitled The Pilgrim's Progress, written in 1678 by the Englishman John Bunyan. So what's the significance of the title? The title is, it's not just any old title.
Yeah, I guess Rob and Catherine and their kids were trying to figure out the name for the farm when they first came, and they were all reading that, and they were just like the journey that the character was on, Christian. They were kind of in the same thing. Their family's mixed family. Like Catherine's husband died, and Rob married, and then they started having their own kids, and then they were in Brazil and back a couple times, and they were trying to find their way in the world. And I think that is
Yeah, the story of Pilgrim's Progress resonated with them, and so they thought, "Oh, let's do Pilgrim's Produce."
It's a journey. It's an allegory about trials and tribulations, and eventually finding sort of a goal that's more than just a physical goal. It's a goal at every level of consciousness, and including sort of a spiritual goal, which organic farming in the 21st century is kind of a a spiritual practice in certain ways. So so they turn down your driveway. What do they see next?
And then it says, please park here in the grass. So the, our parking is just in our yard, in our front yard, basically. And then there's little signs and you have to weave your way through the anniversary garden, as it's called, and then head to the strawberry patch where you sign in and start picking.
The anniversary garden. What's the anniversary
garden? That's another. So this place is just fully embedded with the Hetlers, which is awesome. They planted this, I believe, if I even have the story correct, I think they came back from a trip from Brazil, were inspired by permaculture, and they decided for an anniversary present they would treat themselves to a bunch of trees and bushes. And they filled this this section on the one side of our driveway with beautiful trees, and it's now quite full of, I call it Garden of Eden, because you walk through and you're just picking, you know, little fruits and things as you go the whole way in the summer.
It's kind of like a bit of a food forest.
It's a food forest, yes, yeah. It is.
Yeah, there's, for sure. There's usually, everything. Usually always something to pick.
Yeah, there's something to eat as you're walking through. It's lovely.
The concept of a food forest, which is an ancient concept, is such a wonderful idea. The trees that bring, you know, shade and you know, greenery and a beautiful atmosphere also are a source of food. You just go out and away you go. So they come along the driveway, they pass through the anniversary garden, and what about buildings? What kind of buildings are you going to see in your farm?
Our old farmhouse on the right hand side they'll see, and then we have a big green wash house with, it's a old barn that's been recladded, with farmers like to add lean-tos, so it's got a lean-to bed and underneath that is where we wash and process the vegetables. And then what else? We have about 5 high tunnel greenhouses and one, or they're called high tunnel, like poly covers, and then one heated greenhouse where we start like tomato seedlings and pepper seedlings and stuff like that in there. We don't grow in it really.
Mm-hmm. It's a starter palace.
Yeah. Palace. It gets full. It's great.
How about fields? What kind of fields are they going to see? Obviously not today because there's snow on the ground, but what would they see if it was in a growing season?
As you're driving up to the farm on the right, there's a plum orchard with about 7 different types of plums in there, all unique and ripe at different times of the season. So they're just as strawberry season, because that's one of the first fruits. As strawberry season is starting to wind down, you might get the chance to get some of the plums, some of the early golden plums or something like that, that's available. And then the strawberry patch right now is in one of our renovated fields. We had an old asparagus patch in there, and last year the people picking strawberries actually had the pleasure of picking next to our pigs.
Who are rototilling up the old asparagus patch.
Yeah. So we had our pigs in the old asparagus patch to try and get rid of some of the perennial weeds. And we also had our roots. The roots of the asparagus crowns, because they can be quite hard to deal with. And I'd rather the pigs do it than sitting on a tractor and trying to do it.
And Dan, they're pretty good at it, aren't they?
Oh, it's amazing. Even when they were like wiener pigs, It did not take them very long to work up a patch of ground. They love it. They have so much fun doing it. The worst is when it rains. Because we use electric netting to try and keep them in. But when it rains, they have so much fun, they'll just roll.
They're sliding all over and running around chasing each other.
Roll right over the fencing.
You know, you should have tours of your farm where the people can come and watch the animals having fun, having play as they farm on your behalf.
That is a big reason why we have them, because they bring just so much joy and pleasure for us. We have sheep as well, so they'll see various fields with, we have all different crops. We say A to Z, asparagus to zucchini, because there's just, the fields are just brimming with everything on rotation. So
if this was the middle of summer, people coming to your farm would see this vast array. I mean, you call it a small farm, but it's vast to somebody who has a backyard garden. Yes. Array of vibrant greens of different sorts with different kinds of plants. You know, the different kinds of fruit and vegetable sort of products growing on them, as we say, it would be a pretty productive looking place.
Yeah, especially even during strawberry season, there's a lot of potential in the ground at that point. There's a lot of things started and growing and just about ready to harvest and out of the ground. Oh, it's there's a lot of potential. It's bright green and growing and very much alive, because that's a very productive time of the year. Like, we're getting full daylight hours, and usually June gets a good amount of precipitation, so things are ready to explode at that point of the year.
Just remind listeners that I'm speaking to Dan and Kat Saxton, who are co-owners of Pilgrim's Produce Farm, just south of Armstrong, British Columbia. These days, we use the term organic as if it was something new, but everything grown before World War II was more or less organic. And now we have what a lot of people are calling an organic revolution. Why is it important to go back to this age-old approach to growing things? Farmer Dan?
It's more logical when it comes to especially inputs. If your fertility and that kind of stuff is from your local area, you're not importing and moving things around, because we've conveniently, with cheap fuel, moved farming inputs vast distances. And it doesn't make sense other than through the economy of scale, which we often try and force nature through, which isn't very practical. So it makes more sense, especially when you're talking like heavy inputs like animal manure. If we can get the right amount on our farm, A, we're not going to start contaminating the soil, because sometimes we concentrate manure in some operations in too small of an area, and that causes problems otherwise. And then you get the right type of fertility and you can grow healthy plants that aren't too dependent on like synthetic fertilizers, which focus on NPK, which is a very narrow window to look at plant nutrition and health.
Indeed. When you look out the window, Kat, and you see these fields surrounding your house, and you have your kids, four children, what does that do for you, knowing that these fields are, shall we call it, safe? They're not places where they're going to pick up stuff that they don't need in their bodies.
It's a really good feeling. You don't have to, I don't worry if they're going to pick up a carrot and start eating it and not worried about them ingesting chemicals. And they just have the freedom to roam about, and they really do. They just roam about and eat the fruit. We have one daughter in particular, Amelia, and she's just always dripping with berry juice all the way down. Like, everything she has is stained in the summer. Just loves the fruit. And so there's mulberries and strawberry, and she just goes at it. And it's a really great feeling. I will sometimes get to go out and work in the fields myself and just plunk the baby down in the field, and he can totally stick the dirt in his mouth. I don't mind.
A little dirt is actually probably good for us. According to some actually quite good quality research, allergies, for example, on kids grow up in farms like this, an organic farm in particular, are much less frequent because they're not exposed to weird chemicals. Okay, so let's get down to the practical techniques of organic farming, some of which are new, some of which are old. So let's start off with something you mentioned earlier, Dan, the high tunnel greenhouse. What's a high tunnel greenhouse and what does it do?
So it's just a passive.
A passive greenhouse?
Yeah, it's just a passive greenhouse that, we don't heat it with any sort of extra fuel, wood or whatever you'd use. And it adds about a month and a half on either end of the season, which is really nice, because we can have, like, I just harvested a bunch of romaine lettuce this week. Which, when you see a whole like a foot of snow outside, you're like, okay, it's nice to have. Just like, you can fit a lot in one of those little things, and it makes it worthwhile owning, especially when you can do that the beginning and the end of the season, because it's great for tomatoes in the middle. But to make it worth owning that structure and putting like plastic on it to get an extra a crop at the beginning. So at the beginning, we will seed in by the end of February. It's nice to start getting stuff in the ground. So greens like arugula and Asian greens, which are a really cool party with lots of nice flavor and nutrition. Lettuce, spinach does great almost all winter, which is really nice. And then we'll start by the Ides of March is kind of my deadline to get carrots and beets and stuff like that seeded in a high tunnel greenhouse. So I can have them in May, which is quite early.
So a passive greenhouse is basically a heat concentrator.
Yeah.
We really just have plunked a metal frame with a plastic covering. It's like a cloche over top of the soil.
Yeah.
And sometimes we even move the greenhouse But yeah, basically that it just adds extra heat and now protection from snow and frost.
Which is quite important.
Quite handy in spring and in the fall especially, or early.
Yeah, especially the shoulder seasons are more variable in weather in the spring and the fall. So it protects the crops a bit too, because you can lose stuff.
Speaking of weather variability, because that is becoming a huge issue, how's that influenced not just what you do, but also the way you approach farming? Because it's introduced an element of unpredictability and intensity. How's that affected things for you?
It's kind of, I guess, humbling. Yes. What do you do sometimes? I've been farming for 6 years. And honestly, every single year has been like extremely different. Like early starts, fall starts, no, like some seasons that didn't even feel like they ever started. Seasons that started in February and didn't stop. The heat dome. And then this spring was another like crazy cold. Like, what do we do? And it's like we have to work harder.
We feel like we're trying, okay, we go off of last year, the heat dome, and we're like, okay, we're going to get really heat tolerant plants. And so we do our order, and then it's like a cold spring, and then it's raining a lot. And it's like, we just thought we figured it out. And then, so it is indeed humbling. And you're sort of always playing this game, but realizing, I think that's partly why we have so much diversity and so many different things that we grow, because you just know you're going to lose, you know, you're going to lose something for sure.
And you also have, as a result of this, a heated greenhouse. You have a greenhouse that's independent to some degree of the vagaries of weather. That must have been an important addition, Dan, to have something like that that gave you a little bit of separation from Mother Nature's assaults.
Yeah, it's a nice, safe spot for the tender plants, the tomatoes and the peppers. You want those in the ground as soon as they'll survive, because our season's fairly short, and to get a worthwhile crop of tomatoes or peppers, you need an early start. And they've been doing that for a very long time in Europe and stuff. Like greenhouses and that kind of protected area has always been important. Even our basement that's where we start our first seeding, because our basement's free heat, like we're already paying for it. So I start seeding in January in our basement, and then they go out from there to the greenhouses once it's moderately economical to run it.
Roughly how many seedlings would you start in your basement? I mean, is it an acre? I mean, it's probably quite a bit.
Numbers wise, it sounds a little bit crazy, but onions is one of the first crops we start in the basement, and I will seed 30,000 to 40,000 onions in our basement.
Which is really a few trays.
I think I just faded dead away, but I'm back now. That's a lot of onions.
A lot of onions. I'm including like leeks and stuff like that too. And it's a nice early thing to get going, get a head start, because then you can get really nice onions out of the season. And
what is amazing is that something like an onion seed or carrots, you can hold in your hand something that you will end up putting out and covering acres of land. Like it's just...
Yes.
It is indeed. It's also humbling to just hold all this life potential in your hand, and you hope you don't sneeze or trip, because
it really is quite astonishing that from a seed, a fully grown plant, I mean a tree, if it's the right kind of seed, can grow. It is humbling, and I'm glad you used that term, because I think it's something that when we're looking around the world of nature, we don't really appreciate how much inherent complexity and energy and magnificence is located in very tiny forms like seeds. Now, another way that you sort of protect crops is with row covers. Now, there's different kinds of row covers. Obviously, you probably have more than one kind. Why don't you talk about that a bit, Dan, the row cover?
Yeah, we usually start off with like heavier weight row cover, which helps warm the soil like 2 or 3 degrees, depending on the weight of the cloth. And it does protect from pests. There isn't too many pests in the spring, which is really nice. And then in the summer, we have a really lightweight netting, almost like window screen type, that we use in the summer, because it gets so hot here. You don't want to add 2 or 3 degrees to really any crop that's growing in the soil. So it keeps the pests off most of the crops, most of the time. It doesn't always work. Sometimes they get in there and
Yes, the insect world.
Over the whole, all the fields.
Sure. Yeah. The insect world is quite ingenious. And that's one thing that you have a relationship with insect species. There's beneficial and predatory, but you have a relationship with all of them. Yes. Is that, how much of a preoccupation is that for you, dealing with like an insect infestation you didn't expect or is new or has come at a different time than you expected?
Yeah, this year our spring carrots got hit really hard with something called carrot rust fly, and it took out about 3,000 feet of carrots.
Yikes. In
about a week. They went from being almost just about ready to harvest to I would pull them up and the carrots looked pretty good, but then there would be like 10 worms sticking out of the carrot and be like, okay, so guess where our pigs went?
They went to the carrots.
Yeah.
And now you have extremely healthy, glistening and slightly overweight pigs.
Orange. Yeah. So then the nice thing is, again, like with the weather and with pests, like some of those carrots I worked in and I planted a different crop there instead, like a shorter season crop, because that's the nice thing about not growing one thing. Like if I just grew carrots at the point of that in the season, I might have been able to throw another crop of carrots, but that would have been kind of a dumb thing to plant in the same place anyways. But I threw in some beets that would have been ready for the fall, which this year we had an abundance of beets, maybe because I threw it too many into the ground. But yeah, it's nice with weather too. During the heat dome, I was like, okay, what kind of seeds do I have in stock? And at that point of the year, what will ripen in time for the fall? Or maybe I just have to go to cover crops for this year. And then it's adding organic matter and fertility for the following year anyway. So it's always, we're diverse enough that we have plan A, B, C, hopefully not D.
So what did you find that grew successfully during the heat dome?
Beans loved it. It was hot. Beans love heat. So I was already planting those and I just kept going, realizing how hot the weather was, not knowing that it was going to stay that way all summer. But it turned out to be, we had tons of beans, which is good. And that's good for the soil too. So it adds back to the soil. And then what else did I try? Like our cabbage is what failed during the heat dome. So I planted rutabaga, which doesn't really like heat that much, but it turned out okay anyways. It's a good storage crop that I knew I didn't even have space to put in our cooler, but it's a storage crop that can stay out in the field for a very long time into the winter.
And it's embedded in the soil as opposed to growing above the surface, yeah. Which the cabbage, yeah. Fascinating. I mean, it's a process of sort of a dance between you and the climate and you know, what you have available to grow. Okay, let's talk about stale bedding. That's a term I wasn't entirely familiar with, stale bedding.
Yeah, so you prep your bed to plant into it, and then you, depending on the time of the year, there'll be a flush of weeds. Because when you prep the bed, it brings more weed seeds up. Ideally, I try to not do deep tillage at all, other than for things like carrots and parsnips, which you really like a nice, long, straight root. But everything else gets very minimal tillage, but it still brings weed seeds up. So you prep the bed and depending on which crop, you let it sit for like a week or 2 weeks. And then sometimes I'll even seed into a flush of weeds because even the action of the seeder will weed where I plant the crop. Then I can also use a propane flame weeder from there to just like as fast as I can walk. I usually just flame weed the strip where I plant the seeds. And then we use the biggest tool next, which we have a tractor that's set up to weed in between the rows. And if I do a good job, it really minimizes how much hand weeding, because we start with the biggest tool first, the tractor, but then most crops, it ends up down to the smallest tool, which is your index finger.
A highly developed index finger with a lot of knowledge. Flame weeding sounds pretty clear, but what is your flamethrower?
It's a 20-pound propane tank and one of my old hiking backpacks with a tiger torch on the end of it.
So you're basically walking along the field and you're trying not to melt your boots, and your back has got like ice on it from the propane. So it's quite, it's kind of exhilarating to do the flame week.
It's a little mini climate world that you live in. Cold in the back and hot in the front.
And all the little plants are shriveling as you go. So it feels kind of fun.
Yeah. It's a very efficient way of weeding. And I think I use about maybe 2 tanks of propane a season, not even a tank and a half. So it works really well.
It's pretty efficient. It's a pretty efficient method. And then there's old-fashioned things that everybody in this who's listening to the show will recognize, things like using a hoe and other kinds of implements to sort of cut off roots and generally sort of make things. Do you have like a whole range of hoes, like hoes for hot weather?
Huge, vast array of hoe options.
Dear, the word hoe, it's got all sorts of meanings, doesn't it? So compost. Compost is one of the most interesting sort of amendments that you can put in soil. Interesting because it's so complex and it's so rich and it has fungal elements that are now beginning to be understood better all the time. So use compost. You have a big compost bin or a heap or something like that?
It's a bit of a heap. We're trying to reduce the heap by doing it a bit more efficiently. My dream would to be like to get into permaculture to try and
that's farming worms if anyone
farming worms yes. with our for their compost. That would be my long-term dream, would be to run as much of our compost through like a permaculture type setup, system, because that means I'm not having to turn the pile and manage it, and the worms will do it. And I think you get a more stable product out of permaculture.
And worm poop is highly recommended as an amendment to soil. They sell it in bags at considerable cost. Green compost is a different kind of approach to composting. Why don't you talk about that, Dan?
Anything can be green compost, including weeds. But the nice thing is, weeds are usually doing a job. Things like dandelions, for example, are trying to scavenge calcium. So they're trying to bring that up to the surface. So if you let them, try not let them go to seed is ideal. But for most weeds, they're bringing up nutrients from the soil. So if you mow them down or like silage them, some people would do for compost, you're getting those nutrients out of the soil. And then we use some, I guess, more conventional cover crops. During the summer, peas and oats and buckwheat is another one, which is really good for the bees too, because it flowers within, is it 30 days, 35 days, something like that. You get a nice nectar source for bees. And then for the winter, fall rye is really nice because it grows even when it's super cold and nothing else grows. And what else? Vetch as well to add nitrogen. And
Kat, do your kids come out and help or participate, shall we say?
For sure. They're outside every day helping out just with whatever's going on. They really quite love pestering the workers, getting to know them, climbing on their backs. They'll help, you know, sort or plant, or they like quad rides, you know, of course, they're kids. They were going to come on and tell what they liked about the farm, but there was a mention of our irrigation system is kind of like a water park, like a spray park. So that's fun. And they love the food and they don't like doing the chores sometimes, that, you know.
My
yes,
goodness.
They're out there all the time, every day, climbing trees and whatever. Sometimes they're wreaking havoc.
Well, that is what all of us did as children. We wrought havoc according to our parents' standards, but we're having a really good time according to our own. Now, you have orchards and fruit and nut trees. Why don't you talk about what kind of fruit and nut trees you had, Dan?
Okay, do you want to do the nuts?
Yeah, sure. Rob and Catherine planted about 15 years ago. I was actually a part of helping establish the food forest. So when you're walking up the farm, you have all the fields. So on the left and the right, there's a pathway down the center. And then you come to the raspberries and then the food forest. So there's intermittent rows of nuts. And just all different fruits. So there's pears, cherries of different, they sort of ripen at different stages. We have wart nuts, butternuts, hazelnuts, walnuts, Am I missing anything? There's more.
Pine nuts.
Pine nuts. One There's day. Pine nuts that pine one nuts. Day will harvest, hopefully.
Pine nuts are very costly. This could be a crop that...
Perhaps it's because they take 15 to 20 years to ripen or to turn into a cone that you can harvest and get the nuts from. Yeah, and then there's some more of a habitat area that's planted, so that's just really for nature, for the birds.
And what's in the wild habitat area? Because you mentioned on your website, and I think that's an old concept that's been around forever, that you leave a space for nature and the nature spirits and the energies of nature. What's that like, and how big is that area?
Oh, it's just wonderful. It's kind of, for me, that's the best part of the farm. It's just, you feel like lost in this forest, really. There's huge Christmas trees, and there's, I don't know, what else is there? There's nuts and lilacs.
Berries and Oregon grape.
It's mountain ash and sea buckthorn, and it's just beautiful. It's wild, sort of.
I'm sure there are listeners who are already planning to come out and have a visit to your farm and see all the excitement that's going on here. Mention for listeners again that I'm speaking with Dan and Kat Saxton, who are co-owners of Pilgrim's Produce Farm just south of Armstrong. So you have 7 acres of vegetables, and vegetable farming almost died off in the Shuswap and is just starting to come back. And I think in that respect, you guys are in, as I mentioned, our first show together, in the vanguard of change in food systems and what we grow and where we grow it and how we grow it. Now, as you mentioned earlier, asparagus to zucchini. So now is a chance to recite all of the letters in between A and Z of what you're growing. So
we go have for actually it. Tried that A to Z.
Yeah.
A, asparagus, B.
You specifically said you got zucchini because it was Z.
I don't know.
So it might be too boring if we carry on.
Yeah. We do, yeah, as much as we can, and try and grow the crop in the best season for its growth, even to do with pests too. I try not to do like broccoli and cabbage in the middle of the summer because the pests love them. Madness. And I think it's an inferior product in the summer because we're in the Okanagan. It's too hot to grow really good broccoli and cabbage in the middle of the summer, and a few other crops too. So I try and do like broccoli, cabbage. We do lots of herbs like dill. We do eggplant, and then fennel would be another one we do once in a while too. Garlic, and then I don't know what for H.
Oh, you're actually
yeah. I don't know. I'll probably get sidetracked. But
hascaps.
Oh yeah, hascaps. But yeah, so we do try and grow lots of herbs to give people good flavor and nutrition to make meals out of is kind of our goal. Like we have a lot of soup in our house because we have so many like good ingredients and herbs that we save from the summer for the winter and stuff like that. So
I grew up in a family where of English parentage, where food was only considered attractive if it was cooked to the point where, for example, peas were gray and no spices.
Oh, and no.
You know, you discover spices and suddenly the whole world opens up. So you must, when you make your soups, you must sit there with a row of spices saying, what'll it be this time?
Yes, I have all these huge mason jars of dried herbs that we got from the farm throughout the summer. And it is quite fun to cook and use all these beautiful things that we've grown from the summer. And our freezers, we have 4 deep freezers filled to the brim with things that we've saved from the summer. And so we have lots. We're never without food around here.
Well, and that's a perennial story for people who grow food. That the one thing that the basic thing you never lack is your own product, if you want to call it that. Now, seasonal crop management and of course harvesting requires a team of workers. So, who comes to work in your farm besides just the two of you and those 4 willing helpers of a smaller stature?
Yeah, so this year, I guess use their names, not just number them. So we had our friend Katie, and she's been on the farm for, this was her 4th year.
Yeah.
And then Issa, she's originally from France, but she's been in Canada for a while now. And this was her third season, which is great when you have returning employees. It means we're doing something right, I guess. And then we had a new guy named Elliot, all the way from Vermont. And he only worked 2.5 months, so not the whole season. And then we had Amanda, and she was from Kamloops.
Yeah,
and then Reg, he's our neighbor across the road, and he's been on the farm
for about 10 years.
10 years.
Yep. And then we had Rob, who helped out when he could and wanted to, who is the retired farmer now.
Yeah.
The original owner. And
then during the, especially during strawberries
season,
we have an extra three workers, 3 days a week, at least.
Just crawling around, picking fruit, doing an awesome job.
Yeah.
And then Dan and myself for the crew.
Now what obviously they come from all over, but what kind of people come to work on an organic farm? Is there some common element in their state of mind? What's the state of mind? What kind of people are they?
They tend to be really thoughtful and like down to earth and willing to willing to get dirty, I guess.
Yeah, people who like being outside and working hard. Usually it's more athletic people who are into hiking on the weekends and, you know, stretching their bodies a bit, because farming is definitely a physical stretch.
It's a manual thing.
Yeah, people who care about food, people who care about organic, some people who don't, some people just want a job, but it's usually people who really care about local and organic and, yeah, just working outside with their hands.
Yeah,
people want to learn, have university students who want to, you know, head into this direction for themselves, and they're exploring it. So it's quite a vast, you know, group of people. But
and they produce a fairly vast amount of food. Even again, you call it a small scale, but there's a lot of stuff that comes out of a small farm like this. For example, how many apples? You have a unit of measurement of apples, probably.
We don't grow a lot of apples.
Oh, okay. Let's go to
maybe cherries or plums or pears would be a better one.
Okay, let's do cherries, plums, or pears. What kind of volume, say, of that would you produce?
Oh, for fruit, fruit is definitely more a variable crop year to year. It's vegetables are a little more consistent, but I'll give it a shot for some. Let's see, we do peach plums, which not a lot of people know peach plums. We have about how many? We got two rows. And
this
about
is gonna be a headache.
10 trees in each row, and we'll get like a couple thousand pounds of peach plums off those. And then Italian prune plums is another one that's a bit more consistent year to year. And that one, a bad year would be like 1,000 pounds, and a good year, I don't know, 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. Some of our trees are getting old because Rob planted them 20 years ago. So there's some renovating that needs to be done. I'm trying to work with this old guy down the road who's really into like grafting and propagating fruit trees. So I'm trying to do some of that to get things reinvigorated. Trying to think of some other fruits. Cherries, like we have 100 cherry trees, which we haven't, they're only been really in production for 4 years, but we've had such variable years that it's really hard to give them a number. Usually the first couple of varieties that we have will produce like 100, 150 pounds.
So let's make it easier. Let's do some vegetables. And since the two prominent vegetables were asparagus and zucchini. Now I know zucchini. Zucchini is like a flood tide at a certain time. And asparagus is a little more selective and has very sort of narrow season and that kind of thing. So how much asparagus would you grow?
Let's see. It's about a 6 to 7 week season, and we will pick 50 to 70 pounds. Well, let's say 50 on average, like spread it out, because there's always the bell curve.
What per day?
Every 2 days is kind of what we do, unless it's hot, and then we have to pick it like every day. So yes. I don't know if I can quickly do the math on that.
No, please don't do the math. Leave the math. You're farmers. You don't have to do math.
And then zucchini is another one that we pick at least every 2 days unless it gets hot, and then you have to pick it every day, and that one will be
overwhelming. You'll have things stacked up
like 100 pounds a day at least, and we don't plant very much actually. One summer when I was super overwhelmed, it's one of those crops. We also don't make lots of money on zucchini because a lot of people have it. We like growing it because it's a good food. One summer, I was overwhelmed. I'm like, I can't pick it. So I left it for a week and a half in the middle of the summer. And I went back, and I think I got about a ton, like 2,000 pounds of zucchini just because they were all the size of my leg. Yeah, so they were huge.
Invasion of the wild zucchini plants.
It is amazing when you start looking at how much food an acre can produce. Mm. Like, I wouldn't ever want to grow an acre of zucchini. That would be enough zucchini for like the North Okanagan. It'd be an insane amount. I guess a good, like, carrots would be a good example. We do about a third at the most of an acre of carrots, and it's still like 16,000 pounds of carrots. So it's a lot of carrots.
Astonishing. Yeah. Now, all this food is meant to be eaten, and not everybody comes to your farm to do a U-pick. That's mostly strawberries, I guess. But where, let's talk about where your customers can get this food. So U-pick, we've already talked about a little bit. It's mostly strawberries?
Yeah, we have strawberries and raspberries, hascaps. There's other small little fun fruits like mulberries and currants and some of the fruit trees even they can pick sometimes. So yeah, that's U-pick. We also run a CSA box program.
Right.
That is basically people sign up for a subscription in the spring or even in the late winter, and they can get a box every week.
For listeners, that's community supported agriculture.
Yes, so, I'm so used to saying it.
You are.
Supported agriculture. It's a huge benefit for us because the subscribers, the members pay in advance. So we get the money up front, which really helps with all of our spring startup costs and wages and that sort of thing. Before the food's even ready, they have to pay in good faith that we'll provide. And then once the harvest starts coming in, we're packing boxes every week and we bring it to Vernon, and people also come to the farm to pick it up. So that's our CSA is a big part of our farm.
And the farmers markets.
We do farmers markets. At the moment, we're doing 2 days a week. We go to Vernon on Thursdays, and then we also do Armstrong on Saturdays. We do a little bit of wholesaling. We do some restaurants and caterers, that sort of thing as well.
And online?
And then online, yes, people can go to our website and just see the big list of what's available. They check the boxes, and then they come and pick it up at the farm or sometimes in town as well.
And one thing that's really, I think, unique about this kind of way of doing farming is that you also sell people plants and seedlings, things that they can buy to use themselves.
Yes.
It's sort of like you give out what you're already producing and allow people to produce their own. I mean, it's a wonderful concept that it's not like just us and come to us. It's more like let's get everybody growing something.
Yeah, we definitely very much encourage local, backyard gardeners. And I think we have planting dialed down pretty good. So we have, tomato plants available quite early and all the things that people want to grow in their garden. And we also have chosen some of the best varieties that over years we've been trialing and figured out this is going to be a good tomato on your toast or whatever. So, people can order plants in the spring from us as well.
Now, when food is out of season or when the season is over and you have food to spare, you have to store it somehow. How do you store it? You mentioned the freezers, but that's something for your own perhaps family.
Yeah.
All right. I see a smile on both of your faces when the word
storage. We're both fumbling because this week.
This is what we need to work on. This
we
is
have
where
a storage
we're,
issue.
We're really efficient at growing things. We're out growing our storage at the moment. Like yesterday, luckily I had a strong young guy come and help, and we loaded through our basement window, which is about 2x3. We loaded, what would be a quick number, about 1600 pounds of squash into our basement.
Because it no longer will stay in the greenhouse without freezing. And so where it was, so we're always just juggling and moving things around. We have onions and some squashes in like a big old tractor trailer
unit. Yeah.
That's insulated, but it's not adequate. And then our cooler is, oh my goodness, in the summer it's stacked to the roof. And now it is just absolutely, it's like a carrot mountain and beets. And then we have a root cellar that's like exploding with stuff. So it's just, we have so much food that's stored right now. If anybody wants to buy beets or carrots, come to us.
Yeah. So we have a small cooler, which is, it's pretty good. It's rudimentary. It works well. It keeps things through most of the winter just fine. And we can fit about 10,000 pounds of something. Beets, carrots, It all averages about the same. So we can fit about 10,000 pounds, and it's pretty full right now. And then we have a root cellar, which we usually just store potatoes in there. And we can, again, fit about 10,000 pounds down there. But we didn't have a super good potato year, but we had just like an insane amount of beets. So I've got about 6,000 pounds of beets in our root cellar. Yeah.
The phrase embarrassment of riches keeps on popping up in my mind as you're talking. You're surrounded like a sea of food that just keeps on coming and flowing and moving here and there and everywhere. All of this food, you need to keep a record and a documentation of pattern of some sort. I believe, Kat, you have been tasked with some of this particular.
I might be a little bit more of the organized one in the between the two of us. There's harvest records, so everything that gets harvested has to be recorded by the pound or by the bunch. So that's a tedious task that the workers are constantly weighing and recording things on this ever-growing list in the wash house.
Now, when you say it has to be recorded, is this some kind of farm requirement?
For organic standards, yeah. Yeah, we have to be able to prove what we've grown and match it up with how many seeds we purchased. And, you know, if there's an audit, we have to be able to prove the whole journey from seed to from purchasing the seed. Actually.
Good Lord, this sounds
selling it.
This sounds quite, I wouldn't say tedious, but
it's
probably
tedious and cumbersome. You can say that.
Okay, I'll say that. Okay, tedious. We've agreed on that. So I hope listeners are paying attention to what we're talking about now, because maybe you'll have some people getting in touch with you saying, we need a large number of carrots or beets or something like that. Just remind listeners once again that I'm talking to Dan and Kat Saxton, co-owners of Pilgrim's Produce Farm, south of Armstrong. Now, out of season, there's still a lot of work to do. Obviously, planning, you know, seeding in your basement. And one thing that is also true is that you have connections with a large number of other organizations and food producers and people who sell coffee. I have the list of the logos of all the outfits that you're connected to, and it's a whole variety of things, and just rattle them off. Farmstrong Cider Company, Uprooted Kitchen and Catering Company, Beast and Block, Curlew Orchard. What kind of connections do you have with these various? I mean, they're different. Shuswap Coffee Company, obviously you're not selling them coffee beans. But what kind of connections do you have with these other groups, this kind of collaborative framework that you're part of?
These are basically, there's a variety of different connections we have. Some of them are restaurants that are purchasing our food to use for their menus. Some of them are, a lot of the people there, through our CSA, we have our community supported agriculture. We have invited other local companies to sell their product through our CSA. There's a lot of sort of small scale or even medium scale local growers or producers that we're trying to promote, because we're just really excited about them. Honestly, these are the people that we're buying our dairy from or our honey or our coffee from. And so we want to just help other people be able to access them easily. So you just, for example, people can just through our, if they're a member of our CSA, they can go ahead and add on, you know, milk, cheese, coffee, honey, whatever, maple syrup, and get that just thrown right into their box. So it's super easy for them to access. And then we're also hoping to benefit those local producers. So there's bread and all kinds of things.
And there's a wonderful, the whole process is animated by a spirit of collaboration and cooperation, which I think is also part of the new world of growing food. It's a web, you know, people have talked about this before. It's not a unique concept, but it's a powerful concept because it changes the way you do things with other people. Speaking of other people, and we've talked about them already, there's these four young humans who live with you, who are one of your very best products. and they bring something to the farm. They bring themselves to the farm. What do they do to life on the farm? How do they augment it, expand it, enrich it?
Oh, in so many ways, I've got all kinds of things.
Dan, you're a farm father.
Yeah.
An at-home dad. What's that like?
Yeah, you're never far away from either. You're always doing both. Try not to do work all the time when we're interacting with the kids, but often they're with me doing the work or asking questions, a lot of why questions, which is sometimes it gets annoying, but it's also, it makes me think too, like, why am I doing this? And they're going to hopefully get an educated answer from me rather than because, or whatever those terrible cliches are. So it's really good. Like, I have to think about the work I'm doing. There's an 8-year-old, 6-year-old, 4-year-old, and the 1-year-old, not so much yet, but they ask, why am I doing, like, why are you doing things this way or that way? Or it's not like blindly going to work and then blindly coming home and things are separated. It's very combined.
Mm-hmm. And they're intrigued by what you're doing. You find them doing some of the things you do, just kind of modeling, you model it for them and then they kind of pick up that way, sort of by osmosis almost.
Oh, definitely. And when, like, you know, they're inspired to plant, we give them the freedom and we, you know, we'll purchase seeds for them and they, you know, they'll start their own little flower patch and try. And it's funny because they're quite little entrepreneurs. And so they're, you know, trying to market nuts. They'll go out and harvest nuts and then they'll try and package it up and sell it, or little bouquets or wreaths that are decorated with flowers, or, you know, they're planting their own little things, little experiments in pots and seeing how they'll grow. And they kind of take away some of the seriousness. You know, us adults get so fixated on what we're doing and so important. And then they come in with their little drawing or little, you know, little idea. And they bring, it's fun. And I think the workers really enjoy the children as well. So yeah, they bring a lot of life to the farm.
Yeah. And there's nothing like in January or February when you're out in the greenhouse and you're trying to get work done and seeding, and they just want you to fill up the Rubbermaid tote so they can go swimming.
Swimming in January. That's like a real tradition for our family.
Yeah.
Oh, the January swim.
everybody's covered in dirt and just swimming away while Dan and I are busy planting seeds for the coming year.
So what they bring, their presence, their inimitable and constantly changing presence to the farm. What do you see the farm bringing to them? What does the farm bring to them?
Hopefully a respect for environment and for people, because that's how we have to treat our workers, with respect. We have to treat the world around us with respect, and then also just, like, I guess, the gumption to work hard and get to it and not sit. If you sit around and write out what you're going to do, sometimes it's good to plan, but sometimes you just have to go and get something done. Mm-hmm. And do it.
That's right.
Even the mathematical side, our oldest is always counting the cash for us, and so it's so great because we homeschool as well. And so there, she's practically able to see, like, what's the point in learning how to add or multiply? And here you go. This is a very practical example of why and how. And so she gets to practice that and she really loves it. And so it's fun that there's really practical applications for the children as well.
We're coming to the end of the show now. And I'd like to ask you just to reflect a little bit on what's happened over the last 18 months since you signed the deed of sale and Pilgrim's Produce became your farm. What runs through your hearts and minds as you look back over that year and a half of being the protagonist of this project?
It doesn't feel that different. Like, just because our name's on the title or the deed or whatever the right word is, doesn't feel that different. It's great. Like, Rob and Catherine, the previous stewards of this land, are still next door. And it's like, there's no way I feel like this is my place to just go and cut down all the, like, do whatever I want. And not just because they're here, but, man, it's everyone who walks onto the property and who gets to eat the food. Like, they're just, they own it just as much. Oh, I don't like that word.
It gets to be a part of it.
A part of it.
It just feels like we're carrying on what's been started, and it feels a little bit more real in the, you know, in the paperwork side of things, or in the paying the bills, or, you know, the decision making is a little heavier now that it's more just the two of us. But it really does just feel like we're just carrying on. We're just kind of cogs in the wheel, and we're just going to do our best carrying on and, yeah, growing good food for the community.
I don't think anybody listening to the show today would say anything other than this has been an inspiring romp through a world of the source of the food that we eat, and an exposition, and thank you for the exposition of what actually happens. It's not, there's a miracle at the core of it, as you said, Kat, when you hold a seed in your hand and you know in that seed there is a fully grown plant waiting by some ineffable process to appear and flourish with a little help from its friends. But I think you're really laying out a very clear picture of what food is, where it comes from, and how it gets from this tiny seed into the stuff that you put on your table to eat for supper, breakfast, and lunch, and snacks, and garden carrots out of the ground, and all this kind of stuff. Thank you both very much for being on the show again. Very much appreciated your story and your energy and your vivacity and the enthusiasm with which you have to get up every morning because there's more work to do. So thank you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a
pleasure. You're welcome. Yeah, thanks.